Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN humanitarian agencies and their partners reiterated their commitment to the Afghan people on Friday, stressing that despite a prevailing sense of fear felt by many, they are still able to access people in need across the country. UN Refugee Agency spokesperson Shabir Mantu said that concerns remained about the risk of rights violations against civilians, including women and girls. She also urged Afghanistan's neighbors to accept refugees and reminded the international community not to forget the millions of Afghans in need.
As of today, those who may be in danger have no way out. UNHCR is calling on countries neighboring Afghanistan to keep their borders open in light of the evolving crisis in Afghanistan.
The spokesperson explained that some 200 national and international staff remain on the ground and that the UN agency and national partners have access to two-thirds of all districts. To Haiti now, where Deputy UN Chief Amina Mohammed has arrived to show solidarity with the victims of last Saturday's earthquake, which claimed the lives of more than 2,000 people. After meeting civil society representatives on the Caribbean island on Thursday, the Deputy Secretary General tweeted how important she believed it was to discuss ways to help Haiti resolve the beleaguered country's many crises. According to the World Food Programme, access to the quake-affected south remains a challenge, although the UN agency is using air, sea and road routes to transport essential supplies like food and medicine to these areas. WFP Programme Officer Marianela Gonzalez spoke to us from the capital, Port-au-Prince.
The earthquake is a layer of crisis on top of a much longer, much deeper crisis in Haiti. Here we continue with the distributions, food, hot meals in hospitals, cash, and of course our logistical capacity to support the medical and the humanitarian assistance from different sectors. It's definitely hard to be here today to enter those hospitals, to see people in the street with a roof to sleep under, especially children, but we are here. We're here, and that is a privilege and, of course, a huge responsibility.
Even before the earthquake, recurrent political unrest, gang fights and roadblocks had already limited access to the south. WFP said that it needs $2.5 million for emergency food assistance, including to 215,000 people in Nips, Sud and Grand-Anse. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has condemned an armed attack on a convoy in northern Burkina Faso, which has reportedly led to the deaths of some 80 people. Reports indicate that the civilian convoy was being escorted by military police when it was attacked by Islamist militants near the town of Abinda. As well as the scores killed, several people were also wounded. In a statement, Mr. Guterres expressed his deep concern at the violence orchestrated by extremist groups in the Liptako-Gourma area. He also called for the Burkinabe authorities to spare no effort in identifying and swiftly bringing the perpetrators to justice. The attack comes amid rising Islamist violence in Burkina Faso, which have forced record-breaking numbers of people from their homes. In July, the UN Refugee Agency reported that around 11,000 Burkinabe asylum seekers were in neighboring Niger, up from 7,400 at the start of the year. Daniel Johnson, UN News. Hello. In today's show, urgent humanitarian needs in Afghanistan after the Taliban takeover, the devastating aftermath in quake-hit Haiti, and how the UN Health Agency is helping to snub out potentially deadly Marburg virus in Guinea. All this and more in this week's UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson, and Solange Behetege-Cortez. Thanks for listening. First, the news with Katie Dartford.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The delivery of life-saving aid and medical supplies to millions of Afghans must not be cut, the UN Health Agency has said, citing a threefold rise in the number of trauma cases. According to the World Health Organization, 70 of the health facilities it supports across Afghanistan treated nearly 14,000 conflict-related cases last month. That compares with only 4,057 cases seen a year ago. Sustained access to humanitarian assistance, including essential health services and medical supplies, is a critical lifeline for millions of Afghans and must not be interrupted, said Dr. Ahmed Al-Madari, the WHO Regional Director for the Eastern Mediterranean. The development comes as UN agencies repeated their commitment to stay and deliver assistance to those in need in Afghanistan after the Taliban secured the capital on Sunday. At a press conference in Geneva, UN Children's Fund UNICEF said that 18 million people in the country need aid assistance, and one in three children is expected to be severely malnourished this year. Here's the agency's chief of field operations and emergency, Mustafa Ben Masoud, speaking from Kabul on Tuesday.
While in Kandahar, seen direct impact of this recent flare infighting, and that direct impact is severely malnourished children have seen injured in such a way that it's difficult to describe young children as young as 10 months.
The UN call for solidarity with the victims of Haiti's catastrophic earthquake now, as Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the islanders, "You are not alone." According to latest reports, the magnitude 7.2 earthquake on the 14th of August killed more than 2,000 people and injured around 12,000. In the worst hit areas in the southwest of the Caribbean island, a few houses are still standing. UN Aid Coordinating Office OCHA reported more than 500,000 people need emergency humanitarian assistance. It noted that two additional humanitarian convoys were scheduled to deliver assistance on Wednesday, including medical supplies and healthcare, clean water and emergency shelter. OCHA also noted that aid trucks have faced roadblocks erected by communities with unmet needs, while heavy rains from Tropical Storm Grace have hampered deliveries. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has led a call for UN peacekeepers to fully embrace new technology to respond to ever-changing challenges. Outlining his strategy for the digital transformation of UN peacekeeping, Mr. Guterres told the Security Council that 21st century innovations were changing the nature of conflict and having an indelible impact on civilians. The organization's 12 peacekeeping operations already use many digital tools in their daily work, such as unmanned aerial vehicles and online platforms that provide information about the kind of terrain that blue helmets should expect to encounter. But it's essential that this process picks up speed to improve the UN's agility, anticipation and responsiveness to conflicts, Mr. Guterres insisted on Wednesday. He added that peace operations should develop clear principles on the use of digital tools and undertake human rights due diligence wherever there is potential for harm. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Thanks to Katie Dartford for the news there. And now to this week's interview, which comes to us from Guinea, where UN Health Agency experts are on the ground supporting authorities in keeping the lid on deadly Marburg virus. It's been reported in Gekedu Prefecture in southwest Guinea, and it's the first known case in the country and West Africa. To talk about the prevention measures underway, I spoke to the World Health Organization's representative in Guinea, Dr. George Kizevu.
This is a very significant event that is arising in Guinea for the first time in West Africa also. Marburg virus is a virus from the same family as the virus which causes Ebola. It is usually circulating in animal populations, but sometimes by accident it can be passed to human populations and then from person to person by close contact with body fluids, blood or in health settings. So it is an event that is very serious in Guinea, but also in the region because of the cross-border implications with Liberia and Sierra Leone.
So what are you doing to stop it? There's been one fatality so far, contact tracing,
yes,
presumably.
Yes, the response teams are working at points of entry with Sierra Leone and Liberia. The personnel at the borders have been equipped and trained. And also the communities are being engaged because these communities are circulating. There is a lot of mobility for people going to markets, people going to family events. So there's a sensitization of the community so that they can take all the precautions, especially avoiding touching ill people, avoiding also large gatherings, especially for funerals, which are very, very dangerous events where people can come into contact with a dead body and then disseminate the infection. Contact tracing is also ongoing. We have 150 contacts, but maybe 5 considered high risk, which would be monitored for 21 days, which is the maximum period of incubation to make sure that they are not harboring the virus.
And right, and can I just jump in there quickly, George? Where are these contacts being monitored?
They're in their homes, but isolated from the rest of the family and supported, including with food and other means of hygiene and protective measures, so that they can stay at home for 21 days and avoid transmitting the disease further.
That sounds very promising. Can we just talk about the potential for confusion of Marburg with Ebola and other diseases and other infections? I mean, how confident are you that it won't be spread, because it's not initially easy to diagnose something like Marburg, is it?
Yes. I think the message to the community is really any fever, any flu-like syndrome, to really consult as soon as possible and be tested. I think this is a key message. Marburg is different from Ebola because there is no known treatment or vaccine so far. So we can only stop it through very, very robust prevention at the community level.
And talking about the community, how do you get their trust? Because you're coming in from the outside with the greatest of respect. What does it take to really involve a community in combating something like Marburg?
Yes, what we did was really to enroll social anthropologists, but community health workers also, and risk communication staff who are, some of them are from the community, some of them are actually speaking the same language, so they can use that proximity with the community to engage the leaders at the community level, the elders, the women, the young people from the community, and pass the messages in a way that can be understood and that is in line with the socio-cultural perception of this community. So I think this is something that has worked in the recent Ebola epidemic. We were able to stop transmission in 4 months, even though there is now another alert in Côte d'Ivoire with a potential epidemiological link with Guinea, but we are investigating that. So really community engagement is a key in these outbreak responses.
Talking of Ebola in Guinea and the new Côte d'Ivoire outbreak alert, and not forgetting the 2013-16 epidemic in Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia, has there been any improvement in community engagement since then?
Yes. You know, when we declared the end of the Ebola epidemic on 19th of June this year, 2021, actually the community delegated a lady to come and testify, but they now understood what was the importance of their buy-in and their own ownership, actually, of the response. Because at some point, there were some hesitancy, even some hostility in some of the villages. But through community dialogue, which is an approach that our social anthropologists have tested also in DRC and other responses, we were able to engage with that village and, for example, go and present condolences to the families and do the rituals that they expect from friends with them, and then start the discussion after that.
And George, what's the experience that the World Health Organization has in tackling Marburg in previous epidemics, previous outbreaks?
Yes, we have been there in all the outbreaks in Africa, in Angola, in DRC, and more recently in Uganda. The last few outbreaks were in Uganda 2014 and 2017, but very limited because of the experience developed by WHO in responding. And they were using the same principles as for Ebola. The only difference is that, again, you have to put almost all the effort on prevention in the community, infection prevention and control in health facilities, because you do not have proven or licensed vaccines or therapeutics for Marburg so far, which is different for Ebola.
Can we just quickly turn to COVID then? How is COVID in Guinea at the moment, in the rural areas in Conakry as well?
So Conakry is still the hotspot in Guinea with almost 3/4 of the cases, but it is also spreading in the region, around 100 cases per day, which is a lot compared to some of the periods last year or the end of 2020, and more than 3 or 4 deaths per day, which is also a lot, because we used to have maybe 3 deaths a week, but sometimes we have 3 deaths a day.
And in terms of vaccinations, where are you?
Around 800,000 people out of a population of maybe, let's say, 12 million have received. So it's maybe 6%. This is even with one dose. So I think the target of the health authorities in Guinea is to reach maybe 10% by September, which is high compared to other African countries, and maybe one third of the population by the end of this year. There is a pipeline of vaccines arriving, including the Johnson & Johnson, bought by the government, AstraZeneca, and other vaccines from bilateral cooperation also coming. So the UN is supporting that through the COVAX facility and the AVAT African Union facility also.
My thanks to Dr. George Kizerbo from the World Health Organization for explaining how the UN agency has used its experience in tackling Ebola to work with communities to overcome deadly virus outbreaks together. Now it's time for some closing thoughts from Solange Berhoutegui-Cortez. Hi Solange, I know you found a great literary coincidence linked to this story, so let's hear it.
Hola Daniel. Yes, do you remember the story of the Pied Piper? The town was infested with rats and villagers hired a piper to get rid of them with his magic flute. But when the rats were gone, the citizens refused to pay him, and in revenge, the piper lured away the children with his flute, leading them away as he had the rats. The story, based on a German legend, was written by the brothers Grimm. They both went to the university in Marburg, Germany. Yes, Marburg. The virus, cousin of Ebola, took its name from the village. In 1967, an outbreak was reported for the first time among animal laboratory workers in Marburg and elsewhere in Europe. The current global crisis has shown us how vulnerable our societies are, and at the same time, it acts as a wake-up call. It is time to pay the piper. There is no magic solution. Viruses, any virus, don't just magically disappear. Dr. Kizerbo from the World Health Organization said that we need to stop the Marburg virus in its tracks. And that means that we must all fight it together. Sadly, there is no vaccine for Marburg virus, or at least not yet. But there is regional and international solidarity. At a press conference here in Geneva, the UN Health Agency said that on Saturday, 14 August, Côte d'Ivoire had declared its first Ebola outbreak in more than 25 years. And do you know, it was Guinea that sent thousands of vaccines to their neighbor, Côte d'Ivoire. We cannot leave our future in the hands of magic flutes when we can have vaccines and other simple measures to keep these dangerous diseases at bay. For no reason we should be charmed or enchanted to follow the Pied Pipers of misinformation.
Thank you very much for that literary sign-off. It is a sobering reminder and warning that fake news is as old as the hills. The UN has the Verified campaign to fight misinformation, and if you want more details, then please just log on to unnews.org and search for Verified. Have a good week, Solange. A good week to you listeners. Thank you for joining us. Stay safe. We'll catch you next week. Bye-bye for now.
Chao, hasta el próximo viernes.
Hello again. Before I sign off, here's news of a brand new audio series you might like. It's the UN Climate Podcast, No Denying It. It features young climate changemakers from across our warming planet who show us how we can make a positive impact in our daily lives. Listen in wherever you get your podcasts every Thursday from the 26th of August.
Young people, from the first time in several centuries, they don't believe that their life will be better than their father's.
There's no denying it. Stopping climate change is simple. We need to stop digging up fossil fuels and burning them just to get energy.
Our current climate crisis is directly linked to colonization when we think of colonization as a system that's always thinking about extraction.
It's hard to focus on individual rights or our wealth inequality if literally they can't breathe the air or there's fires pushing them out of their communities or their home.
Quitting our addiction to fossil fuels is going to take solutions in every industry, at every scale, in every nation on the planet.
It's not because of CO2. It's because we approached the planet with an unbalanced worldview. And so, of course, eventually the world became unbalanced. So if we can take some lessons and teachings from indigenous cultures, if we as individuals can hold a balanced view in our minds, then it's just a matter of time before the world balances as well.
Our vision is to be able to replicate this process in every part of the world that there is sea and fishermen.
It made you understand your place better, made you feel really humble and want to work a lot to preserve the well-being of this planet that has existed so many ages.
No denying it, the UN Climate Action Podcast brings you the voices of young climate changemakers from across our warming planet. These activists, engineers, and entrepreneurs show us how we can make big changes in our homes, our jobs, where we vote and pray, and with our family and friends.
I believe everyone is put in this world for a purpose. And my purpose was always to create a dent in the universe by impacting the environment space. That is my purpose.
We all have to start somewhere, but the important thing is to get started. There's no denying it. Find No Denying It, the United Nations Climate Action Podcast, wherever you listen.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. As the global aid community marked World Humanitarian Day on Thursday, UN Chief Antonio Guterres paid tribute to all those who help people in need before urging support for the day's hashtag the human race campaign and its focus on protecting the world's most vulnerable from the climate emergency. Humanitarian workers are here to help the world's most vulnerable people when disaster strikes, the Secretary-General said, adding that in the past 20 years, shootings, kidnappings and other attacks on humanitarian organisations have increased tenfold. This year alone, at least 72 humanitarian workers have been killed in conflict zones. Turning to this year's campaign for World Humanitarian Day, hashtag the human race, which highlights how climate extremes are causing misery across the world and overwhelming frontline responders, Mr. Guterres warned that the climate emergency is a race we are losing, but it's a race we can and must win. Hosting on exercise platform Strava, participants are asked to clock 100 minutes of exercise for the World Humanitarian Day campaign. They can run, roll, ride, walk, swim, kick or hit a ball. Each action will count towards helping us carry our message to world leaders when they meet at the UN Climate Change Conference in November, said UN Humanitarian Coordinating Office OCHA, which is behind the campaign. The global initiative to save the planet's biodiversity on land and water must not be allowed to threaten the world's most vulnerable people, a top human rights expert said on Thursday. Under a UN-backed global biodiversity framework draft agreement, countries have agreed to protect 30% of the planet and restore at least 20% by 2030. UN Special Rapporteur David Boyd said that although the plan was essential to conservation efforts, it must not be achieved at the expense of further human rights violations against indigenous and other rural people. Minorities, including people of African descent, rural women and rural youth, were not adequately prioritised in the current draft plan, Mr. Boyd insisted, despite the fact that their knowledge and conservation contributions must be recognised, respected and supported. The independent rights expert, who reports to the Human Rights Council, cautioned against what he called fortress conservation approaches that aim to restore pristine wilderness where no humans live. The call comes ahead of an October conference in Kunming, China, where representatives of 190 countries will seek to finalise the UN post-2020 Global Biodiversity Framework. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has led a call for UN peacekeepers to fully embrace new technology to respond to ever-changing challenges. outlining his strategy for the digital transformation of UN peacekeeping, Mr. Guterres told the Security Council that 21st century innovations were changing the nature of conflict and having an indelible impact on civilians. The organization's 12 peacekeeping operations already use many digital tools in their daily work, such as unmanned aerial vehicles and online platforms that provide information about the kind of terrain that blue helmets should expect to encounter. But it's essential that this process picks up speed to improve the UN's agility, anticipation and responsiveness to conflicts, Mr. Guterres insisted, before adding that peace operations should develop clear principles on the use of digital tools and undertake human rights due diligence wherever there is potential for harm. Katie Dartford, UN News. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The delivery of life-saving aid and medical supplies to millions of Afghans must not be cut, the UN Health Agency said on Wednesday, citing a threefold rise in the number of trauma cases. According to the World Health Organization, 70 of the health facilities it supports across Afghanistan treated nearly 14,000 conflict-related cases last month. That compares with only 4,057 cases seen a year ago. Sustained access to humanitarian assistance, including essential health services and medical supplies, is a critical lifeline for millions of Afghans and must not be interrupted, said Dr. Anid Al-Mandari, the WHO Regional Director for the Eastern Mediterranean. Dr. Al-Mandari explained that months of violence has heavily impacted Afghanistan's already fragile health system, which, in addition to the many challenges posed by the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, continues to face shortages in essential supplies. The WHO senior official also insisted that the UN agency was committed to staying in Afghanistan despite the uncertain situation following the Taliban takeover on Sunday. His comments come a day after WHO dispatched trauma and burns kit equipment to Kabul's Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital and enough basic medical kits to assist 10,000 people for 3 months. Reliable fuel and electricity are needed urgently in Lebanon to avert a potential humanitarian catastrophe, the top UN aid official in the country has warned. Najat Rushdie, UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Lebanon, said that fuel shortages are threatening the provision of essential health and water services, putting thousands of families at risk. The energy shortages have forced the country's largest hospitals to reduce their activities further, which combined with the COVID-19 crisis may affect the delivery of life-saving treatments, Ms. Rushdie said on Tuesday. Public water supply and wastewater treatment systems that rely on fuel have also been cut back, leaving millions without access to water. Nationwide, roughly 4 million people have been affected after the country's chief electricity provider halted supply to water authorities. In an appeal to restore the current, Ms. Rushdie called for all stakeholders to work together to find a sustainable and fair solution. A warning now from UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet that transgender people still lack protection from abuse around the world amid an alarming rise in hateful discourse against them. In her appeal to push back against proposals that roll back protections against the trans community, the High Commissioner for Human Rights insisted that wherever they live, their rights should be respected in law and in practice. Speaking at the Copenhagen Human Rights Forum on Tuesday, Ms. Bachelet said that every country in the world should recognize trans people's gender based on self-identification. Although there have been advances in legal protections of trans rights since Argentina's pioneering law in 2012, only a small minority of countries have taken similar steps, the High Commissioner said. She cautioned that where laws recognising the gender of trans people do exist, they are often accompanied by deeply abusive and humiliating requirements, from forced sterilisation to medical certification and divorce. That is not by any means inclusive, she said. Ms. Bachelet urged both for freedom to be who you are without fear or persecution and to love. Katie Dartford, UN News.
I'm Deanne Penn with UN News. In the lead-up to World Humanitarian Day, marked annually on the 19th of August, climate justice advocate Mitzi Janelle is clear that the climate crisis is a humanitarian crisis. While most people consider the environment a scientific problem to be fixed by the scientists, the Filipino youth activist is determined to put an empowering human aspect into the climate crisis battle involving everyday people. Her optimism surrounding the ability of youth to move the needle towards climate action is contagious. When we unite, there is so much power there, she told UN News' Liz Cassidy.
The climate crisis is a humanitarian crisis, and it's something that we don't see the links as often in mainstream media and the way we talk about the climate crisis. Although more and more it's starting to change, but we're still seeing how people talk about the climate crisis as an environmental problem, as something that's a scientific problem to be fixed by the scientists and the world leaders, but not something that people, everyday people, can be involved with because they are impacted themselves. And so it lacks that empowering human aspect, which I think needs to be talked about more.
What is it you want others around the world to do to highlight climate action?
So on World Humanitarian Day, just like any other day of the year, I will be campaigning for climate justice, really bringing attention to how the people who are most marginalized, the people who are most vulnerable, the people who are least responsible for the climate crisis, they're the ones who are most affected. And these are also the people who have the greatest stories of resistance, and these are the stories that we have to be amplifying and listening to, because if we don't listen to the voices who are most marginalized, we'll end up with climate action that leaves people behind. And that's not the climate action that we want or that we need. We want climate justice that includes everyone, development that includes everyone. But I want others around the world to do to highlight climate action. Really, at its core, climate justice is just about caring about people who are outside your immediate bubble. It's about caring about people who are the most marginalized and recognizing their agency to lead and seeing that they actually know what they need. We just need to listen to them and empower them and build their capacity to do these things.
Are you hopeful that the need for climate action is a message that is getting through?
There are days when I'm not as hopeful, but generally, I honestly just believe in the revolutionary power of the youth. It amazes me how if you look at every single historical moment in society, the youth have been there leading the way with the most marginalized sectors of society. And when I remember that the youth is part of every sector of society. They're in the workers, we're in the middle class, we're in the LGBT groups, we're in the racial justice groups, we're everywhere because there's a young person in all these sectors. So when we unite, then there's so much power there. And when we learn from each other and we realize how really climate justice is just about building a community that cares about each other, that's the future that we're fighting for. And when I think of it that way, when I think of how there's so many of us coming together, fighting for the same thing in different ways and learning from each other, then for me it's impossible for us to not get that better future that we're fighting for.
It seems that every day we hear how climate change is affecting everyone. Can you speak to the impact it's having on humanitarian efforts?
We're seeing how more and more people are having to do humanitarian work because of the impacts of the climate crisis. So it's not just whenever there are extreme weather events like typhoons and droughts, but it's also the increased risk of forced migration and refugees and the human rights issues that come along with that and the social justice issues that come along with that. So I really think that climate action is more than just drastic emission cuts. It ties in with humanitarian efforts and making sure that we are able to adapt, making sure that when people are being impacted by these effects, there is a way for reparations for the loss and damages that they've experienced. And in the end, that's really a humanitarian effort.
How can the world focus on climate action in relation to humanitarian work and humanitarian aid?
There's this concept in the Philippines called Bayanihan, which I have absolutely no clue how to translate, and I guess the best way to translate it is coming together as one community, coming together when there's someone in need for the public good. And I think that's what we should be looking at when we approach climate justice and climate action, the same way we approach humanitarian work and humanitarian aid. Why do we do it? Because we care about people. Because we're building a community, not the way that society has taught us, that community is just the people you're familiar with, the people that look like you, but really a community of everyone coming together because this is one planet that we're fighting for, and that's how I think we should be approaching it.
What can the UN do to help encourage these actions?
I think the UN has a powerful voice and has such a big platform to amplify these voices of resistance. I think something that lacks in a lot of humanitarian work is that empowering aspect. I've seen at least 20 for the Philippines. I've seen that we've been portrayed as some people who are helpless, people who need to be saved. And that's not the kind of humanitarian work that we want. The kind of humanitarian work that we need is the type that's empowering and that makes us work together rather than helping the people who are marginalized. And that's something that we need to really focus on more and really shift the narrative from being a voice for the voiceless, but rather amplifying the voices. Shifting it from fighting for people and fighting alongside people. Shifting it from giving people food to giving people ways to cook.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
I've already said it, but I would really, really like to emphasize that the climate crisis has to shift away from being this environmental issue that's so separated from people. A lot of people say that, oh, the climate crisis is a middle-class issue. It's something that people who are starving, people who don't have a house to live, can't connect with. But the thing is, these are the people who are most vulnerable to the climate crisis. But we've kept it away from them for so long because we've talked about the climate crisis as something about the environment, about carbon dioxide emissions. We've kept the science and climate crisis so separated from the people, and that's what we need to do. We need to come back to that. We need to come back to just building community.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The delivery of life-saving aid and medical supplies to millions of Afghans must not be cut, the UN Health Agency said on Wednesday, citing a threefold rise in the number of trauma cases. According to the World Health Organization, 70 of the health facilities it supports across Afghanistan treated nearly 14,000 conflict-related cases last month. That compares with only 4,057 cases seen a year ago. Sustained access to humanitarian assistance, including essential health services and medical supplies, is a critical lifeline for millions of Afghans and must not be interrupted, said Dr. Anid Al-Mandari, the WHO Regional Director for the Eastern Mediterranean. Dr. Al-Mandari explained that months of violence has heavily impacted Afghanistan's already fragile health system, which, in addition to the many challenges posed by the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, continues to face shortages in essential supplies. The WHO senior official also insisted that the UN agency was committed to staying in Afghanistan despite the uncertain situation following the Taliban takeover on Sunday. His comments come a day after WHO dispatched trauma and burns kit equipment to Kabul's Wazir Akbar Khan Hospital and enough basic medical kits to assist 10,000 people for 3 months. Reliable fuel and electricity are needed urgently in Lebanon to avert a potential humanitarian catastrophe, the top UN aid official in the country has warned. Najat Rushdie, UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Lebanon, said that fuel shortages are threatening the provision of essential health and water services, putting thousands of families at risk. The energy shortages have forced the country's largest hospitals to reduce their activities further, which combined with the COVID-19 crisis may affect the delivery of life-saving treatments, Ms. Rushdie said on Tuesday. Public water supply and wastewater treatment systems that rely on fuel have also been cut back, leaving millions without access to water. Nationwide, roughly 4 million people have been affected after the country's chief electricity provider halted supply to water authorities. In an appeal to restore the current, Ms. Rushdie called for all stakeholders to work together to find a sustainable and fair solution. A warning now from UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet that transgender people still lack protection from abuse around the world amid an alarming rise in hateful discourse against them. In her appeal to push back against proposals that roll back protections against the trans community, the High Commissioner for Human Rights insisted that wherever they live, their rights should be respected in law and in practice. Speaking at the Copenhagen Human Rights Forum on Tuesday, Ms. Bachelet said that every country in the world should recognize trans people's gender based on self-identification. Although there have been advances in legal protections of trans rights since Argentina's pioneering law in 2012, only a small minority of countries have taken similar steps, the High Commissioner said. She cautioned that where laws recognizing the gender of trans people do exist, they are often accompanied by deeply abusive and humiliating requirements, from forced sterilization to medical certification and divorce. That is not by any means inclusive, she said. Ms. Bachelet urged both for freedom to be who you are without fear or persecution and to love. Katie Dartford, UN News. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Afghan civilians continue to bear the brunt of the Taliban takeover in the country, where humanitarian needs remain critical and widespread among existing and newly displaced populations, UN agencies said on Tuesday. Some 18 million people in the country need aid assistance, and one in three children is expected to be severely malnourished this year, said the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF. Here's the agency's Chief of Field Operations and Emergency, Mustafa Ben Masaoud, speaking in Kabul on Tuesday.
Right in Kandahar, seen direct impact of this recent flare infighting. And that direct impact is severely malnourished children have seen injured in such a way that it's difficult to describe young children as young as 10 months.
Inside Kabul, Mr. Ben Masoud said that the situation was improving, although mobile health teams from the World Health Organization had been forced to halt operations in recent days owing to insecurity. There is great need there that we need to attend to, the UNICEF official added. Vaccinations to prevent the spread of Ebola virus have begun in Côte d'Ivoire following discovery of an outbreak there 3 days ago. Confirming the move, the UN Health Agency said that high-risk populations, including health workers and first responders, had received shots on Monday in the West African nation. Vaccines were made available from neighboring Guinea, where an outbreak of the highly infectious hemorrhagic disease was declared over on 19th of June. In a statement, the World Health Organization said the Côte d'Ivoire outbreak was declared after the authorities confirmed that Ebola virus had entered the country via a patient who's travelled to Abidjan by road from Guinea. The patient is currently receiving treatment at a hospital in Abidjan, said the World Health Organization, which added that effective early treatment and supportive care can significantly improve chances of surviving Ebola. The rapid expansion of humanitarian assistance is needed in crisis-hit northern Mozambique, the head of the IOM, the UN Migration Agency, said on Tuesday. Speaking from Metugé district, which hosts over 125,000 people displaced by insecurity in Cabo Delgado province, Antonio Vitorino explained that although IOM reaches tens of thousands of families every month, significant additional funding is needed. This will cover life-saving humanitarian needs and help to implement durable solutions, Mr. Vitorino said. In the last week of July, more than 9,200 displaced people were on the move, according to the UN agency. In the first half of this year, IOM Mozambique provided assistance to more than 600,000 in Cabo Delgado. However, it warned that operations remained underfunded, with $58 million needed to support work in Mozambique, including $21.7 million to respond to immediate life-saving humanitarian needs in the north. Katie Dartford, UN News. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN Security Council prepared to meet on Monday to discuss the crisis in Afghanistan after Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged the Taliban and all other parties to protect lives and ensure that humanitarian needs can be addressed. In a statement, Mr. Guterres said that he was following the situation with deep concern as Taliban forces entered the capital, Kabul. The UN chief also warned on Sunday of reports of serious human rights abuses and violations in the communities most affected by the fighting, highlighting the immense challenges inside Afghanistan, where conflict has forced hundreds of thousands from their homes. UN Aid Coordinating Office, OCHA, insisted that humanitarian organizations were committed to stay and deliver to millions in need. Isabel Musa Carlson, OCHA head of office in Afghanistan, tweeted on Sunday that aid teams would carry out their work while adhering to the humanitarian principles of humanity, neutrality, impartiality, and independence. In Haiti, rescue and relief efforts continued on Monday after a 7.2 magnitude earthquake struck over the weekend, reportedly claiming 1,300 lives. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres expressed his sadness over the loss of life and destruction in the southern part of the Caribbean island, while UN humanitarians warned that gang violence there could hamper aid assessments and delivery for weeks. According to UN Aid Coordinating Office, OCHA, the quake's epicenter was around 12 kilometers northeast of San Luis de Sud, about 125 kilometers west of the capital, Port-au-Prince. In addition to the dead and wounded, initial reports indicate more than 700 collapsed buildings, including hospitals and schools, more than 3,700 homes destroyed, and significant damage to roads. Local hospitals are already overwhelmed with wounded people, OCHA said, especially in Lekay and Jeremy, but help is being provided by the Red Cross and hospitals in unaffected areas. Some 30,000 Palestinian refugees in southern Syria who are registered with the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, have become increasingly vulnerable following recent clashes in Daraa's governorate, the UN agency has warned. UNRWA said on Sunday that around one-third of them used to reside in the Daraa's camp for Palestine refugees before the conflict, and recently a small number have returned to the camp due to lack of alternatives. However, ongoing hostilities have dramatically reduced the agency's ability to provide them with critical services. More than 600 Palestine refugee families or 3,000 individuals who now reside in the camp face dire humanitarian conditions, UNRWA said. The agency has reported depleted medication and food stocks, including bread, following the closure of the main Saraya humanitarian crossing on the 30th of July. Water and electricity are also completely cut off inside the camp. UNRWA has called for all parties to the conflict to ensure unimpeded access for humanitarian assistance into the area and for the Saraya crossing point to remain open to allow Palestine refugees access to basic services. Katie Dartford, UN News. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Afghanistan is on course to witness its highest number of documented civilian casualties in a single year since records began, the UN Refugee Agency said on Friday. As widespread fighting intensifies, the UN agency said it was particularly concerned about the impact of the conflict on women and girls. Here's the UNHCR spokesperson, Shabia Mantu.
The human toll of spiraling hostilities is immense. The United Nations Assistance Mission has warned that without a significant de-escalation in violence, Afghanistan is on course to witness the highest ever number of documented civilian casualties in a single year since the UN records began. We are particularly worried about the impact of the conflict on women and girls. Some 80% of nearly a quarter of a million Afghans forced to flee since the end of May are women and children.
Concerns are also growing about chronic hunger levels in the country, where one in three people are acutely food insecure and 2 million children urgently need nutrition treatment. The situation has all the hallmarks of a humanitarian catastrophe, said the World Food Programme, which has appealed for funding to help reach 9.1 million people by December. The World Health Organization has urged all countries to put differences aside to help understand where and how the COVID-19 virus started, including the unproven suggestion that it was manufactured in a laboratory. The move, announced late on Thursday, comes after a joint report was issued in March by the WHO and China into the origins of the coronavirus. It determined that there was insufficient scientific evidence to rule any of the hypotheses out about how the coronavirus spread, while the UN agency explained that to address the lab hypothesis, it needed access to all data. Future research would need to include a further examination of the raw data from the earliest COVID-19 infections, the WHO said, adding that it had already received information from a number of countries that had reported finding the virus in blood samples taken in 2019 before the outbreak was declared a pandemic. These countries included Italy, the WHO noted, adding that it encouraged all countries, including China, to support the hunt for COVID's origins. Rival armed groups in the Democratic Republic of the Congo are carrying out horrific sexual attacks against women and girls, the UN Refugee Agency has warned. The alert was prompted by what the UNHCR has called widespread and systematic abuse in Tanganyika province, where thousands of people have been internally displaced this year, often many times. Spokesperson Shabia Mantu told journalists in Geneva that the rival armed groups responsible for the attacks were competing for control of mining areas, especially gold mines, and that the abuse was linked to retaliation for government-led military operations.
Our staff have heard horrific testimonies of extreme violence. Forcibly displaced people have accused armed groups of carrying out mass rape as women attempt to flee their homes. Some women and girls have been abducted and used as sex slaves by armed group members. Ransoms have been demanded from families in exchange for their freedom.
The UN agency said that it remains committed to helping the survivors, but work is hampered by the ongoing violence and the long distances people have to travel to reach medical centres. Katie Dartford, UN News.